Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So listen, how's the weather by you? I ask, well, because I care, but also because it turns out temperature matters economically. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Khan Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday. Today's the 1st of March. Good to have you with us, as it always is. 60-ish here in L.A. on this Thursday. A little bit on the cool side, but it's going to warm up a bit tomorrow and over the weekend. Unseasonably warm, actually. And that's been the pattern in much of the country this winter. And believe it or not, the temperate climate might just be giving us a little too much confidence in our economy right now. I say that because a survey from Blue Chip Financial Forecasts says two-thirds of Wall Street economists think all the good weather is making things look better than they really are. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has the story.
These economists don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but they say the drier and warmer winter in recent months has, quote, led to an overstatement of the economy's underlying strength. I called economist Ellen Zentner at Nomura Securities in New York to ask why. But first, how's the weather?
Oh, it's dreary as usual, but it is warmer than usual today.
Zentner says milder weather has stirred up economic activity that's normally rather ho-hum in wintertime, like shopping.
To a certain extent, milder weather makes us more upbeat. We go out and shop more. Certainly, the malls raked it in, and we actually saw the malls gain share on internet shopping.
Not to mention new construction, says Wells Fargo economist Anika Khan. She's in Charlotte, where it's a balmy 79 today.
Housing starts were exceptionally strong for the month of January.
Economist Mark Zandi in Philadelphia at 51 and cloudy even attributes stronger home sales in part to the recent weather.
Probably a bit stronger than otherwise would be the case. Even the jobs data has had a firmer tone to it in part because of the weather.
But Zandi says in the end, this is a good weather spike.
And so we just have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Once the weather becomes more seasonal, things are going to go back to normal.
Normal, as in steady but slow economic recovery. In Los Angeles, at 61 and sunny, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Yes, 79 in Charlotte, warmer than here? That's just not right, man, I'm telling you. Crude oil closed at almost $109 a barrel today. Worries over problems with Iran and what turned out to be unfounded rumors of a Saudi pipeline explosion tipped the scales higher. Elsewhere in the never-ending story of how to get those prices lower, Shell Oil has gone to court in Alaska. It's trying to preempt what it calls time-consuming lawsuits from environmental groups. The company's asking a federal court to review its already tentatively approved plans to drill in the Alaskan Arctic this summer. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Summer is the only time when oil exploration is possible in Alaska's Arctic Ocean. Shell spokeswoman Kelly Optive says the company's worried that a springtime court challenge will mean a year's delay.
It just makes good business sense to do this now. I mean, after investing $4 billion, we want to responsibly develop that significant energy resource and create thousands of jobs.
Shell's attempt to expedite court action is merely paving the way for its environmental opponents, says Kyle Cooper with IAF Advisors in Houston.
Certainly, if that gets filed and it gets circulated, then those who would oppose it now are on watch to go round up their troops and file countersuits against it.
Attracting public attention just might be the method behind Shell's legal madness. With gasoline prices heading north of $4 a gallon, Shell is trying to strike while public sentiment is behind more domestic production, says Carl Larry with the New York research firm Oil Outlooks and Opinions.
People are going to say, let's try to find a way to get prices lower. And if Shell has a good argument here, they're going to get public sentiment on their side. We might say, look, we're willing to not bring it from Canada on a pipeline, but we do need to bring it from Alaska, where we already have pipelines.
Plus, Larry says, by filing first, Shell gets to choose the court venue in relatively oil-friendly Alaska. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Something of a rebound in the equity markets today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Iowa this week, the state legislature created the new crime of agricultural production facility fraud. Makes it a crime to get into or try to get into an animal or crop production facility under false pretenses, say by lying to get a job, and so by extension making it very hard to get video footage of what goes on inside. Whistleblower groups and animal rights activists don't like it much at all. Joe Tseng is an Iowa State Senator. He's a veterinarian as well, and he co-sponsored the bill that's waiting for the governor's signature. Dr. Tseng, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Why do you think the state of Iowa needed this law?
Actually, we're an agricultural base, and there have been attempts by certain groups to discredit the agricultural industry to the point where they stage their own productions against owners actually within their own facilities.
Without doubting that might have happened, you understand how this looks, right?
I understand that they think U.S. constitutional liberties are being violated. And I assure you, we have been with the AG's office on at least 8 to 10 meetings, and they've assured us that no constitutional liberties are being violated as far as videotaping. Actually, it doesn't even not allow videotaping or recording devices in there.
Right. It talks only about trespassing. But I guess my point is that setting aside animal rights activists, even the most militant animal rights activists, there are people and groups in this country who are worried that if we have to kill animals for food, we should do it in the most humane way possible. And the only way to get that information is to go undercover because plants and organizations and companies don't want that information public. They don't want us to see how we treat our food supply.
The U.S. Constitution says that you cannot enter a person's private property without former knowledge. Even a policeman has to obtain a search warrant to get on a piece of property. These are private businesses owned by either farmers or corporations that have strict biosecurity facilities that do not want either birds, mice, vermin, anything like that, even cockroaches entering into these facilities, people included.
What about the idea that we have a long history in this country of investigative journalists and others going into facilities like this? This goes back to Upton Sinclair in the jungle, from which we got reforms in many industries that have worked out to the betterment of not only the animals, but the people as well.
I would think the people that, like the news media, anything like that, this law that we just passed is not prohibitive against that. This is mainly entering a facility under fraudulent reasons. This law is not prohibitive from anybody that's seeing abuse occurring within these facilities that works there to take a picture of that and report it to the authorities. That is still in place. The whistleblower provision is not touched with at all. It's strictly fraud.
Bearing in mind that you're a veterinarian, though, sir, do you think these plants, and I assume you've seen your share of animal abuse, do you think plants and workers are actually able to police themselves and to have employees be whistleblowers in the truest sense?
It's sort of, I would say it's maybe a little bit vague in that area. There are always abuses in any industry. So I would say the jury's out on that one. I think the bill that we passed is mainly for protection of industry that is dedicated to actually feeding the world in the next 25 years. I'm trying to reach middle ground. This bill that we passed is a much toned-down version from the other one. It was actually 10 years in jail, and it was moved down to 1 year in jail, so as far as a maximum penalty. So,
Dr. Joe Tseng, he's a veterinarian and a state senator in Iowa. Dr. Tseng, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
These are busy days for state legislatures. It seems down in Florida, there's a bill pending to stop people from using food stamps to buy foods that are unhealthy. Sugary snacks are on that list. Commentator Mark Bittman says that's a fine idea, but one that doesn't go quite far enough.
Florida State Senator Rhonda Storms could never be thought of as progressive. But her bill puts her in the same camp as New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who suggested something along similar lines, only to have it batted down by federal ag officials who described it as too complex. What's not complex is our relationship with sugar. We eat too much of it, half a pound a day per person, and it makes us fat. The processed food industry says sugar is not to blame. A calorie is a calorie, they say. Limit your total calories, regardless of where they come from, and your health will be fine. Well, that's total nonsense. A calorie of refined sugar is far more likely to cause damage to your body than a calorie of, let's say, fiber. With sugar, we're in a situation where a dangerous substance is perfectly legal and available everywhere. It's sold without restriction to everyone, and it's marketed with billions of dollars to children before they can even speak, let alone reason. What choice do we have but to regulate it? Just as we would and do regulate tobacco and alcohol and, for that matter, firearms. This is so obvious that Florida state senators not known as forward thinkers can see it, though the Department of Agriculture evidently can't. But this is precisely what government is for, to protect us from things from which we can't protect ourselves. Sugar's not exactly an invading army, but it can be thought of as a hostile force. And big food has succeeded in getting us to eat way more of it than is good for us. Willpower alone isn't enough to stop that. We need national defense.
Mark Bittman is a columnist for the New York Times, also the author of How to Cook Everything. Drop us a line about what you're eating or cooking or anything else you want to tell us. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says Contact. Coming up.
At the far end of town where the crickle grass grows and the wind smells slow and sour when it blows.
Can I read?
The Lorax goes to the movies, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 28 points today, 0.2%, closed at 12,980, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ jumped 22 points, 0.75%, finished at 2,988. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, 0.6%, ended things at 1,374. Consumers spent more at Kroger supermarkets. Sales rose nearly 8% in the latest quarter, and Kroger shares zipped up 2.75%. Reports that Bank of America may boost fees on checking accounts could anger consumers, but hey, investors, man, they were happy. B of A shares rose 1.9%. Rival banks scored even bigger gains. Goldman Sachs up 5%. Morgan Stanley closed up about 3.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.03%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Get outside and play. How often have we heard that? The White House hosts a conference on conservation, growing America's outdoor heritage and economy. March is National Women's History Month. This year's theme focuses on education. And musician Lou Reed turned 70. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. In the Senate today, the health reform law was up for a vote again. This time, the requirement that contraceptives be covered. Democrats voted down a Republican challenge to it. But along with jobs and the economy, the president's health care law and a similar one in Massachusetts, signed by former Governor Mitt Romney, are going to be election undercurrents this year. So what do you think about that?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
We talk to Frank Newport every week on the broadcast. He's the editor-in-chief of Gallup, and it's a segment we called Attitude Check, what's really going on in the minds of voters out there. Frank, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So there is healthcare news today about President Obama's healthcare reform bill. RomneyCare from the state of Massachusetts, while Mitt Romney was governor, has been in the news. Newt Gingrich talked about it the other day. Question for you today is, what does it mean for those two men should they face off in the election? Do voters care about healthcare and reform laws?
Well, they care more at this point about Obama's having been associated with the 2010 law than they do about Romney having been associated with the law when he was governor of Massachusetts. That was a law passed in 06. In fact, only a third of voters say Romney's law, his opponents call it Romney Care, but only a third say it makes a difference. And that tilts negative, driven by Republicans, about a quarter of whom say it makes them less likely to vote for Romney, makes him too moderate. For Obama, it's actually 60% who say it makes a difference. And it, too, is more negative than positive because a lot of Republicans says the law makes them less likely to vote for Obama. And there are not enough Democrats to make up for it that look at the law more positively.
You mentioned how it breaks down along party lines, which is, of course, as we would expect. So let me ask, among the independents, the ground on which this general campaign will eventually be fought, what do they think about health care reform writ large?
Well, they tilt more negative than positive about Obama's law. For everybody putting it together, it's about a 15-point negative skew. For independents, it's about a 12-point negative skew. In other words, more independents say they're going to be less likely to vote for Obama because of his association with the law, then more likely to vote for him. So even in that key group, and you're right, they're the swing voters that everybody's going to be going after, his health care law in 2010 tilts more negative than it does positive.
What do they say about whether it was just bad policy or whether it was unconstitutional? I ask, obviously, because this case will be in the Supreme Court, I guess, this month, right, March?
Well, you know, we asked that question. Now, some people say, how can you dare ask Americans who are not lawyers whether it's constitutional when you know, the appeals courts don't even know. They disagree on whether it's constitutional. That's the mandate part of the law.
Right. The part that said everybody has to have health coverage. Yeah,
that's right. That's how we explained it to them. We said everybody has to have health care or pay a fine. We even put that in the question wording. But their knee-jerk reaction, three-quarters of Americans, 76%, say it is unconstitutional. But, you know, the Kaiser Family Foundation in California asked a similar question, and they gave an out. They said, or do you not know enough about it to say, which is probably reasonable. But they only had 28% who opted out, and they, too, found a majority whose immediate reaction was that that individual mandate part of the law is unconstitutional.
Yeah. As with everything in polling, it's all about how you ask the questions, right?
Well, how you ask the questions makes a difference, no question about that. But we look at all the different wording, and out of that comes truth, Kai.
There you go. Well, one hopes, anyway. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. You can find more about it and about Gallup's polling on our website is marketplace.org. Frank, we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
This might be too grand a thing to say based on just 1 month's worth of data, but it's entirely possible the American automobile industry is back. February sales figures came out today, and more cars were sold in this country last month than at any point since March 2008, practically an economic lifetime ago. With those sales, of course, come jobs in manufacturing and related industries. And for the next week or so, jobs are all we're likely to hear about from the GOP presidential candidates as we head into Super Tuesday. And that's part of what our election coverage is about, the real economy. Manufacturing in the Midwest is seeing a rebound, but some of the biggest job growth in some of the key swing states, like Ohio, isn't coming from the Rust Belt staples of steel and cars. From WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio, Brian Bull reports.
Mark Morton is a chef of Nestle USA. The company's product development center is here in Solon, Ohio, and Morton's hard at work in a test kitchen.
These are some sliced shallots. The starting point of the sauce, I'm going to caramelize them in just a little bit of oil in a hot pan here.
Morton's experimenting with entrees that may soon end up in your grocer's freezer.
Once these are brown, then I'll add the celery and the carrots. You know.
Morton is one of more than 70,000 Ohioans working in the food processing industry. Richard Linton chairs Ohio State University's Department of Food Science and Technology. He says with more than 1,700, Ohio leads all states in the number of food processing businesses.
It helps our economy. That helps place jobs here in the state.
Linton expects the sector to add at least another 15,000 jobs in the next decade. Jobs, of course, are a major issue this election year. John Green heads the Bliss Institute of Applied Politics at the University of Akron. He says Democrats and Republicans will fight to take credit for Ohio's growing manufacturing sector.
President Obama's arguments about stimulating the economy, about strategic investments in particular kinds of industries, and also the Republican arguments about lower taxes and decreasing the costs of government, all those things potentially play with Ohio voters because a lot of people in Ohio are very concerned about the manufacturing sector.
It's hard to quantify just how state and federal policies have affected Ohio's fortunes, but one thing that's helped is its location smack dab in the middle of the Farm Belt. Bob Cohen teaches agriculture at Kent State University.
We see from Lake Erie down to the Ohio River very diverse resources that enables everything from wine, grapes, and fruits in the north to tobacco in the south and beans and wheat in the west and a lot of vegetables in between.
Ohio is also close to major markets in the Midwest and East Coast. Cohen says the processed food industry does well in tough times as consumers go out less and dine more at home.
The saying goes, you always got to eat.
Yet despite the food industry's resilience, there are casualties. Jay Cult is the executive vice president of Chefco, a meat distributor in Cleveland. He's taken more than a dozen businesses off his client list over the past few years.
There was a manufacturer in Warren that couldn't compete with Nestle's in producing pocket sandwiches, a couple of hot dog companies here in town. Those businesses were run out of business based on buying power and pricing by the big boys.
Proving that as important as the food industry is to Ohio, it's not without its own food chain, where the lake trout still feast on the minnows. In Cleveland, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, you know, a new movie appears with a little orange Lorax. You're sure to shed tears over how he defends the truffula trees, or tries to, at least, as the Onceler makes the needs. This story has lived for four decades now. Our reporter Eve Trode takes a look back at how the tale pits nature against industry from the Marketplace desk of sustainability.
Okay, I'm not going to compete with Kai or Dr. Seuss for rhymes. Theodore Geisel had such a way with language, he could sell beachfront property in Kansas. And in 1971, he used his whimsical words to sell environmentalism.
At the far end of town where the grickle grass grows and the winds smell slow and sour when it blows.
Can I read?
That's writer Henry Myers and his son James reading The Lorax. Its message is stark. An entrepreneur, the Onceler, finds a pristine forest and starts cutting down all the trees. He's warned not to by a curious orange creature.
And he spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy.
Mister, he said with a sawdusty sneeze, I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees.
I speak for the trees. That mantra is more famous now than it was when The Lorax came out, says Troy University historian Elizabeth Bloom.
This was not one of his bestsellers. It was not something that was, you know, hotly anticipated at the time.
But it did fit with the times. In 1971, President Nixon had just created the Environmental Protection Agency. Tough pollution legislation was speeding its way through Congress. The news was full of stories on oil spills or rivers so polluted they caught fire. Bloom says the famous author had an awakening.
In the 20s and 30s, he did a huge, very successful ad campaign for a pesticide called Flit. I think that the Lorax is a way of him making peace and atoning for what he saw as his role in the pesticide business.
Or any business, maybe. Bloom calls the book a screed against capitalism and materialism.
Directly attributing environmental harm to people purchasing things.
In the book, people go crazy for thneeds, a mysterious all-purpose garment, and every single truffula tree gets cut down to make them. So it's easy to cry foul on product tie-ins for Hollywood's new Lorax.
And who received the only certified truffula tree seal of approval? Mazda, with sky-active technology.
Cars, computers, hotels. Though the studio says it has been careful with which products get to use the Lorax. Julie Corbett runs Ecologic Brands. The Lorax will be plastered all over a recycled paper bottle she designed for Seventh Generation. She says the Lorax book didn't account for responsible business.
Humans are humans and we need to sustain ourselves. The idea of renewable is quite important.
Not simply don't cut trees, she says, but rather don't cut all the trees before others grow back. Christina Page directs sustainability at Yahoo. She loved The Lorax as a kid, but now she finds the book too gloomy.
I think if the book was being written today, The Lorax would probably start a locally run co-op of truffula tree, biodiesel, and sustainably harvested fruit.
We do have more nuanced conversations today. Peter Lehner is executive director of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says that's mostly because we have to.
It's a much tougher challenge we have today because the rivers aren't on fire, because the air is clearer. Global warming is more complex than having a factory next door that is poisoning your drinking water.
Getting an hour and a half movie out of a short kid's book is more complex, too. The Lorax screenplay adds a backstory, a love interest, and musical numbers. In the book, the villainous industrialist, the Wantzler, is shown as a faceless arm of corporate greed. In the film, he's a fully fleshed-out character. That alone suggests this new version of the Lorax offers a different take on business and the environment. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is going to appeal to the Ron Paul fans out there. His best-known saying, of course, is end the Fed. It's followed closely, though, by it's only money if you pull it out of the ground, by which he means gold. So I found a website courtesy of my Twitter feed today called pricedingold.com. You can look up pretty much everything, natural gas, food, you name it, priced in gold. I clicked on college tuition, and it turns out that if you're paying in gold, a year at Yale University costs about the same right now as it did in 1900. 1 kilogram, 35.27 ounces of the shiny yellow stuff. Of course, today there is that price of gold thing to deal with. Today, about $1,700 an ounce at the close. All right, there you go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 28 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ jumped 22 points, 0.7%. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, 0.6%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same channel, same station, same time. You know the drill. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.